Boston reporting 20 met with a bit of
Welcome to Radio Free Aotearoa. Right, I thought that with the war on Afghanistan and with the very rapid developments that we've been seeing recently in that country, it was important to just pause for a moment and try to think about what kind of country are we talking about, and trying to understand Afghanistan. So I've prepared a small presentation of the country, starting by the people who live there, going on to a bit of history about Afghanistan, before moving on to the different political forces that are on the political scene at the moment, and asking a few questions at the end in terms of what next. So in terms of the country itself, it's quite important to remember that Afghanistan is at the crossroad of six countries: Iran in the west, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and a small corridor into China in the north, and then Pakistan in the east and the south. So it's quite a complex country, geographically speaking. But it's even more complex when we look at the mosaic of people who live inside that country. The 26 million inhabitants speaks very various languages, in the west and the northwest Persian. That's the parts that are close to Iran and Turkmenistan. In the north and the northeast, people speak Turkish, a dialect of Turkish. That's the parts of the country that are closest to Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and China. And in the east and the south, they speak Pashto, the same language that we can find in Pakistan, on the other side of the Afghan border. As for the ethnic groups that live in this country, in the north we've got the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Hazari, who they are all minority groups, and they are currently to be found in the Northern Alliance. As for the rest of the country, it's inhabited by the Pashtuns, who constitute 40% of the population, and they're the largest ethnic group. So if we look at this country, this complex country, it reminds us of Switzerland, and another country where, I suppose, Switzerland without the banks, but another country where you've got fragments of nations and people that are stronger in the neighboring countries, outside of the country itself. And Afghanistan is definitely a country that's culturally pulled apart, but what holds it together, what holds all of these people together, is a common struggle against any foreign invasion. Moving on to the social organization, traditionally Afghanistan has had a tribal system supported by the mountains, the mountainous nature of the country, with very, very few contacts between the people across the mountains. And because of this tribal system, we have their tribal leaders or tribal lords that are often fighting old feuds against other tribes, peasants, the mullah, who are the priests, and merchants, the middlemen, with a pivotal role in quite a fragmented society. So this is a place, really, of constantly shifting ethnic and regional alliances, and that was never really unified under a centralized power. And central government has always, always been very fragile. So that was an overview of the people who live in Afghanistan. And I'd like now to talk briefly about the history of the country. Afghanistan was first a kingdom with the help of the British Empire. Ahmad Shah Durrani founded the Durrani dynasty in 1747. But even then, the Kyiv never really had total control over the whole country. It was just a chief, a tribal chief, who was a little bit more powerful than the others, and with the support of the British Empire, managed to create this dynasty. So this leads us to basically the 20th century and the early 1970s. Then, at that moment, a military coup took place in order to modernize the country. The objective of the military officers that were involved in this coup was to extend access to education both in the cities and in the countryside, to enable women in the cities mostly, not really in the countryside, but to enable women in the cities to have access to employment, and finally to impose the rule of law in a country that was that was never really subjected to any rule of law. So as a result of this modernization, at the end of the 1970s, 50% of all civil servants were women, which is quite an accomplishment, but we are still left with quite a dual, with definitely a dual society. On the one hand, the city centers, Kabul, Mazar-i-Sharif, Herat, that knew a certain modernization, with quite a modernized elite around, including the army officers. But the rest of the country that existed, we could say, in the Middle Ages, no electricity, no telephones, no roads, no health facilities, no education, both for girls and boys. And as a result of this modernization that was started in the 70s following this military coup, there was a backlash, a very, very strong resistance from the fundamentalists that was supported by the tribe leaders, the mullah, and the merchants, mostly around the question of women's access to education and women's access to employment in the city. So a resistance there that leads us to a civil war. The fundamentalists, supported by the United States and by Pakistan, were used really as a tool against a pro-Soviet Union regime. And it's quite important to remember that this happened in a country where Islamic extremism barely existed really as a force in Afghan politics. But this was built by the United States with the support of Pakistan in order to fight against this military regime. And the military regime, as a result, as a consequence, asked for help from the Soviet Union against those mujahideens, the fighters, the resistance. And a military invasion happened in 1978, a military invasion by the Soviet Union. However, because the Soviet presence in Afghanistan didn't manage to settle the issue, the civil war just continued and got worse and worse, leading to the complete withdrawal of the Soviet Union in 1989, and the continuation of the civil war once the Soviet Union had gone. So the Northern Alliance managed to rule for some time, but the Taliban's took over finally in 1996 and imposed their rule of law, forcing the Northern Alliance into a very small corner of the country, only 10% of the country, in the northeast corner of the country. So that's how we have basically almost 22 years of war. So let's now look at the political forces that are engaged in this in the current situation. So on the one hand, we've got the Taliban. Taliban means students of law, but students who are now defeated in the largest part of the country, but they're still quite an important political and military force. But what I'd like to look at is really their social base. How did the Taliban come to exist, and how did they come to How did they become such an important political force? Going back to what I said about the social organization of the country, the mollah, those priests, and the merchants, as well as the tribe lords who were against the modernization started in the 1970s, are definitely the strong pillars of the pillars of the Taliban movement. However, the Taliban's needed the troops. The troops to support them in their war effort and the troops to fight. And those troops were constituted by the large, the enormous portions of the population who were orphans of the war, of those 22 years of war. So among the refugees, there were hundreds of orphans, refugees mostly, I'm talking here about Pakistan, sorry, though there are lots of refugees too in Iran, but I'm looking only about the refugees who were in Pakistan. So hundreds of them were orphans, and they were collected by these Talibans into the madrasas, the Quranic schools, in Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan, but also in Pakistani cities that are ruled or run rather by the same Islamic clergy as in Afghanistan. Remember, we've got the same tribes over the two sides of the border of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border. So here we are with youth who grow up without any love, without care, without any women around them, and whose sole education comes from the Quran, that's written in Arabic, a language that they don't speak. Therefore, the Taliban are very much the product of the madrasas, a unique breed of men, and a breed of men that only knows harshness against women, definitely, harshness against any opponents, harshness against themselves too. And this movement has been facilitated by the sociocultural conditions of Afghanistan and the high literacy rate of that existed when the civil war started. The Northern Alliance now is heavily drawn from the ethnic minorities, the northern ethnic minorities, the Tajiks, the Uzbeks, and the Hazaris, the Shiites. It's a very unstable alliance of tribes and ethnic groups, and they spend as much time really fighting against the Taliban as fighting against each other. And they are now temporarily, I can't say more than that, temporarily united by the first General Massoud and then Dostoun's and then General Dostoun. So they're now presented as the good guys, as our allies. But we should never forget the atrocities and the crimes committed by the Northern Alliance when they took over Kabul for the first time, and their entry into the capital was marked by raping, burning, slaughtering, ethnic revenge, and it was really a period of misrule in Kabul to such a point that the population was quite relieved when the Taliban arrived and entered Kabul and took power, because they at last imposed some rule of law, their rule of law, as opposed to what the chaos that existed under the Northern Alliance domination. The third part is the third element in these political forces is the king. The king, who's 86 years old, who lives in exile in Italy and who hasn't ruled since the 1970s, this king was when he was in power, he didn't do much for his country. Remember, we talked about that dual country where there was no electricity, no telephone, no roads, no health facilities, no education for boys or girls in the countryside. And he didn't really create much support around him. And this also propelled the military coup of the 1970s. So having all of that in mind, we might now wonder what comes next. So the Northern Alliance, is it an acceptable partner, political partner for the future? It is important to remember that it is drawn from the minority ethnic groups from the north of the country, and as such is not acceptable to the majority of Pashtuns, nor is it acceptable actually to Pakistan and the Pakistani regime. It's also important to remember that they're extremists, just as extremists as the Taliban are. And they're an extremely unstable alliance. And as their recent entry into Kabul, against the orders given by Washington and supported by London, demonstrated, they are definitely not at the orders of Washington. They are not controlled by Washington. And that is a major issue. For the Americans, who want to put their hand on the country and make sure they can stabilize the country through a stable partner, through someone that they can talk to, as they were able to do it and were very happy doing it with the Taliban during the whole time the Taliban controlled the country. So the Americans want a stable partner, and the Northern Alliance is not. Now, the second option that we've been hearing about recently is the king. There again, it's quite important to remember that this is not a new option, a new solution at all. In 1988, on the eve of the Soviet Union withdrawal from Afghanistan, the United Nations urged the King Zafir Shah to return, the very same king that we're talking about now, to return to Afghanistan. But at that time, the United States and Pakistan very strongly opposed that solution, and they preferred to support Islamic extremism through the Mujahideens and later on through the Taliban. So that sounds like an option that now they're looking at newly, but that was not acceptable at the time, despite the fact that this king has not changed. What he was going to bring in 1988 is exactly the same as what he's bringing today, except that he's a lot older and hasn't ruled for an even longer period of time. The other important thing to keep in mind in this with the king solution, or the so-called king solution, is the fact that this country has never really been ruled by one centralized power, and I don't think that a centralized government in a country that is so split and so traumatized is possible. For me, it's really an illusion. And only a search for a federal structure in which the regions and the ethnic groups can have a greater autonomy seems to be a possible, step towards a future stable government. Now, we've also heard about the UN, a UN-backed solution. The UN have been, the United Nations have been quite absent from the scene since September the 11th, but in the American search for support for their attacks and their bombing of Afghanistan, Colin Powell, the U.S. Secretary of State, has approached the UN, the United Nations, to ask them for a UN peacekeeping force for Afghanistan. However, the UN is extremely worried about being stuck with the legacy of 22 years of war and an impossible mess. And they still remember the very difficult situation they were left with in the former Yugoslavia, Bosnia and Kosovo. So the Americans then moved on to suggest that the UN, the United Nations, could act as it did in Cambodia in the run-up to the elections it supervised in May 1993. But it's important to keep in mind that first in Cambodia, the peace process became possible because the great powers and Cambodia's neighbors concluded that the conflict had gone on for too long. And that is not the case in Afghanistan for the moment. What's more, in Cambodia, the conflict was not overlaid with deep ethnic splits. So the UN here would be facing a much, much more complex situation than that they had to deal with in Cambodia. Now, another scenario has been coming out of the very recent development, and it's the division, the possible division of the country. And the fall of Kabul, the capital, happened so quickly and that it didn't actually give time to the Americans and their allies, the British, to form the government that they wanted, the stable government that they wanted for Afghanistan. And therefore, the Northern Alliance arrived in Kabul without a government coalition able to run the country with a minimum of stability. And in the medium term, given that the Talibans are now in their stronghold and they still have the whole base and their great backup support from the Islamic fundamentalist forces in Pakistan and also in the Arab countries, it is possible to imagine that they will keep holding that part of the country and that a division, a virtual division of the country happens and might suit the Americans' need for some sort of stability in the country. In all of this, there is one point that I haven't tackled at the moment. It's the resistance of the population. We've talked about political forces. We've talked about the great powers. But it is also important to look at the population's resistance because they haven't been all, very happy with the arrival and the rule of the Taliban. And one thing which is really important to remember is that, and that might explain why the Americans are so reluctant to send their boys on the field in Afghanistan, on top of course, their history, their past history, and the lessons learned from Vietnam, is the fact that if there is an invasion of the country by the West, we can be sure that that will be a resistance from the majority of the population and, if necessary, fighting with the Talibans against the invaders, against the Americans. But the resistance that we can see in Afghanistan, inside Afghanistan and outside, inside the refugee camps in Iran and Pakistan, is a movement of resistance mostly for the education of children and girls in particular among children. So it's important to keep in mind that the terrible state of the education system and of education in general in Afghanistan goes back a long way before the Taliban took over, because then already 9 girls out of 10 and 2 boys out of 3 received no education at all. So reports now tell us that about 45,000 children are being educated secretly inside Afghanistan, many of them girls, and that some women have also secretly returned to work. Two organizations seem to have been mentioned as part of this resistance movement: the Revolutionary Labour Organization of Afghanistan, the RLOA, with activists both in exile and inside the country in various provinces, working in working in small groups and in cells that don't really have contacts with each other, given the situation of secrecy that they've got to work in. And then the Revolutionary Association of the Women of Afghanistan, RAWA, that was established in 1977 in Kabul for women's rights, social justice and democracy, with many activists now in the refugee camps in Pakistan, but still some working inside Afghanistan. So these secular groups work among women, and their objective is really to start establishing schools with hostels for girls and boys, that's in the refugee camps, with hospitals, with mobile teams for refugee Afghan women and children in the camps again, but also targeting women through their literacy, nursing and vocational training courses. Now, as a conclusion, I would say that in this unnecessary war, unfortunately that's the word that we have, that needs to be said and repeated, this war against Afghanistan is an unnecessary war, and it's an unnecessary war against one of the poorest countries of the world, and it's a war that's led under a pretense, the pretense of catching Osama bin Laden. And I haven't talked about Osama bin Laden on purpose, because Osama bin Laden has nothing, absolutely nothing to do with Afghanistan, very little to do with the Taliban, except that he was trained by the CIA, trained by the Americans and the Pakistans alongside with the Taliban, and therefore developed very strong links with the Taliban, who then welcomed him to come and use Afghanistan as a base for his terrorist acts around the world. But in the first place, Osama bin Laden has nothing to do with Afghanistan, and this is why I haven't at all dealt with him or talked about him. So in this unnecessary war and against Afghanistan, under the pretense of catching Osama bin Laden, the real objective for Washington is to accelerate American influence in this vital region. And it is really important then to remember that there has been a vacuum, a power vacuum in the region since the collapse of the Soviet Union, and that the stakes are high for the control of the Caspian Basin oils.